Thanks, Beth. So thanks everyone for coming. And yeah, so I guess this is one of the things you get once in a while when you organize something. You have to step in at the last minute when one of your speakers cancels. So Vern is not here, but yeah, as Beth mentioned, this is we did a paper together with one of my students, Nathaniel Johnson, on some things, and it had an extended introduction on the sorts of things I'm gonna talk about. So let me point out that there is a paper that Beth referred to that's appeared in Quantum Information and Computation earlier this year that the things I'm gonna talk about are most of the things I'm gonna talk about are included in an extended introduction in that paper. Right, so I guess what I'm gonna try to do, so it's a mixed crowd scientifically, so what I'm gonna try to do is probably impossible, but I'll try to do it anyway. I'm gonna try to give sort of a very very basic and gentle introduction to some of the operator structures, some of the fundamental operator structures and notions from operator theory that come up in quantum information. And so this is a talk mainly aimed at those in quantum information, but I think, at least I hope, that those coming from, you know, one of the sort of subdisciplines of operator theory will get something out of it as well. In particular, sort of looking at things from a slightly different perspective. And I think one of the themes you'll see, at least in a couple places, is that for those who don't know, I think at least intuitively to me, somehow operator theory and quantum information are duals to each other, or at least the perspectives that you generally come from are duals to each other. Okay. So, oh right, yeah. So where I'm going, so since I don't have electronic overheads, let me tell you where I'm going. So I'm gonna give an introduction with some notation. I'll say a little bit about open quantum systems and dynamics, and then I'll move into discussion on completely positive maps, which everyone knows about, or at least most people here know about. But I'm gonna come at it from a perspective that in my opinion, I think should be better known in quantum information. It's becoming better known over the last few years, but it deserves some discussion. So that's mainly coming at it from the Stein-Spring dilation theorem perspective. And then I'll get into some basics on completely bounded maps and norms and concrete operator spaces that we'll see as we in other talks as we go along. Okay, so to begin with then, this is my introduction and some basic things just to establish notation. First of all, yeah. Oh, yeah, and I moved it over even when I wasn't supposed to, right? But, oh, you don't think I should? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Maybe like so. My maximum. Okay. Okay, so some basic things to begin with, again, to establish notation. So first of all, of course, everything is going to happen on Hilbert space. And my generic dimension number will be n, okay, and it'll be a finite dimensional space for the purposes of my talk. Most of the things I'm gonna talk about have carry over to infinite dimensions, or at least have an infinite dimensional analog, but just to sort of streamline things, I'll focus on the finite dimensional case, which is, of course, of extreme importance in quantum information. And we'll use the Dirac notation. So for instance, for unit vectors, we'll have ket psi, okay, or in other words, states, quantum states. And then density operators, row. Okay, so inside B of H, and I should say right off the bat, I'm not going to distinguish between the operators and the trace class operators. Okay, so again, to streamline my presentation, and I know some people will object to that, but what are you going to do? So I'm going to take advantage of the fact, in other words, that we're in finite dimensions and we can identify the set of all operators with a set of trace class operators, but I'll make a comment on that in one or two places as we go on. Okay, and one last point notationally. If on the, we have partial trace maps whenever we have a tensor product. So if H decomposes as a tensor product, we can define partial trace maps. Okay, so for instance, partial trace over A takes us from operators on H to operators on B, defined on elementary tensors like so. So sigma A tensor sigma B goes to the trace of sigma A times sigma B. Okay, so we're, yeah. Whoops, thanks. Yeah, okay, right. Okay, so there's the notational need. Now, so a word on dynamics.
Yeah. I mean, there are two movable words on top.
Oh, you think I should just stick to those? Is that what you said?
Otherwise, it would cover the
missile. Yeah, okay. All right, yeah. This is a lot of combinations here. Okay. right, okay. So let's say a little bit about open quantum systems. And the associated dynamics. Okay, so with every open quantum system, we have a Hilbert space. Right. So how do we think of the dynamics in an open quantum system? Well, we consider the first thing we do is we consider a large enough environment such that the composite system H together with that environment is a closed system. Okay, so consider an environment E, all right, thinking of it as a Hilbert space, so E is a Hilbert space such that H tensor E is closed. In particular, then what that means is that, so from the postulates of quantum mechanics, we know that the dynamics on a closed quantum system are going to be unitary. And if we assume that our initial starting point at our initial point in time, we have some control over the initial state of the environment, which is a standard. It's often an assumption made in quantum information. We get the following. So, with E initially in the state psi sub E. The full closed system, H tensor E, evolves unitarily. Okay, and so in other words, we can think of it in terms of a map. Okay, starting off with some operator on H, right? We can regard, first of all, the first step as a map, tensoring row with the rank one projection, onto the environment state space, and then our unitary dynamics come in. So we have some unitary U right that we're going to conjugate. So we're going to take rho tensor that environment state and conjugate by the unitary U and its adjoint. Okay, I'm going to use daggers. fried joint, and then to see what's going on at the system level, we throw away the environment, we trace out the environment. So in other words, we do a partial trace over the environment of this whole thing, and we're left with we're left with a map, right? On H that we define as partial trace over the environment closed with the unitary map okay, so where script U is conjugation by U and its adjoint. Okay, so I'm sweeping all sorts of stuff under the rug from the physics perspective. I mean, I'm suppressing any reference to time. So in other words, we're thinking of this as a sort of a discrete snapshot of the dynamics. But in any event, that gives you the basic picture of what's going on. And so, of course, what we know, I'm going to digress on this point in a moment. We know this is a completely positive trace preserving map. I'm going to come back to this and come full circle as I go along. But one point I do want to make at this point is that there is a slightly more notationally convenient way to write this generic form that I'll call the isometric form that gets you thinking in more in the direction of how you see things from the operator theory perspective. Okay, so we can define whenever we have such a setup, such a map, we can define an isometry. V, okay, going from H to H tensor E, okay, by sending vectors to taking that vector, tensoring it with the environment state, and then hitting it by U. Okay, so that's an isometry. And most importantly, in terms of this form, it simplifies, right? This form simplifies with the introduction of V, so that we can write E, our map E of rho, as partial trace over E of script, so that's a V, script V, just acting on rho. Okay. All right, so that's a perspective that everyone working in quantum information knows well, at least the unitary form, and I mean, this is the isometric form is just a simplification of it. It's maybe not such a standard form if you're coming from the perspective of operator theory, but what I will show you, or at least if you've seen it sort of hanging in the air a little bit before, what I want to show you is that it really is equivalent to the perspective from operator theory that that you're used to, if that's the perspective you're coming from. Okay. All right. So to get there, though, I'm going to digress and pretend, at least just for a moment, that we don't know what a completely positive map is. Okay? Just for a very short moment, don't worry. Okay? And now we'll say some things about completely positive maps. Okay? So, first of all, what is a completely positive map? All right, so if we have a linear map on B of H, okay, we say it's completely positive if an entire family of maps are positive. Okay, so for all n greater than equal to 1, the natural maps, the extended maps, write it like this, the identity on n, that's too early, right, for my alarm? Okay. Okay. We can extend, we can take E and tensor it with the identity on the n-dimensional identity channel or map, and and think of this family of extended maps. So if the maps are all positive, if every map in this family is positive. Okay, so it's a strong condition, but satisfied by enough things to make life interesting. So the case of interest generally in quantum information is the case where you have this condition satisfied, but you also have trace preservation. Okay, so E is a quantum channel if E is completely positive and trace preserving as well. Okay, for example, and it's not just an example, it's the, I mean, I'll come back, as I said, I'm going to go full circle here, but any map that has that form we just discussed. is a quantum channel. Okay, is completely positive and trace preserving. And the basic point there is that when V is an isometry, both these maps are completely positive and trace preserving. And maybe. Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Board management. I play golf, or at least I try to play golf. Not very well. But there's this term in golf called course management, which basically means if you want to wimp out on a shot. Oh, what am I doing? Okay, that's good. Okay, anyway, forget that tangent. So these are completely positive trace preserving maps. One way to see it is through the Choi matrix, and why not briefly mention the Choi matrix. The Choi matrix for the map called D subscript E looks like this. So if I have a basis for n-dimensional space indexed by positive integers from 1 to n, okay, I build the Choi matrix by the Choi matrix is an n squared by n squared matrix that looks like this. Okay, with the Dirac notation, and so the point is that Choi matrix is a positive matrix. It gives you a test for CP. Choi matrix is positive if and only if E is completely positive, and so you can use that to check that this is a completely positive map, and also the generic form of a completely positive map is easily seen, well, to give you a CP map from this perspective. So if E has such a form, summation over I, EI, rho, EI, star, EI dagger, where the EIs are operators on H. Okay, so this is easily seen to be a completely positive map. In other words, the matrix you build here is going to be positive when that's the form of your map. And again, I'm pretending that we don't know for the moment, but we'll see that this actually is the generic form for a completely positive map. Okay, so to those who are just seeing this for the first time. Okay, now to bring things sort of full circle, or at least tie things together, how do we do that? Well, we do it through the dual map. Okay, so the dual. The dual of a completely positive map. Okay, dual in what sense? Well, in the sense of the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. Okay, so given a linear map E, okay, on B of H, we can define its dual map, its Hilbert-Schmidt dual map, called E dagger. Okay, which again with my notation is also going to act on B of H via this equation. Okay, so here's how it's defined through the traces. So, trace of rho E dagger of X is defined to be the trace of E of rho times X. Okay, so that's for all rho, for all X. Now, again, so here's where some might object to me not distinguishing between the trace class operators and the operators themselves, but in a sense I am with my choice of letters, so hopefully you'll give me that. But yeah, so in general, one of these will act on B of H, one of them will act on the trace class operators on B of H, okay? But right, so there's the dual map. Well, there's a couple of things that are very easy to check. So for instance, well, if E has this form, has this nice form, okay, so EI rho EI dagger, well, E has that form, if and only if E dagger has the form summation over I EI dagger X EI. Okay, so there's a nice dichotomy between these two notions. Also, it's easy to see that E is a unital map. Okay, so E is a unital map. Okay, if and only if E dagger is trace preserving. Okay, which both of these things can be encoded in terms of these operators EI when you have them in hand, but trace preservation is equivalent to this identity being satisfied. Okay, so that's the dual map. Now, how are things linked together? Well, if I was, here's good use of board space. Okay, so I've got this form up here. Remember that generic form we saw from open quantum system dynamics. Well, the natural question to ask is, what is the dual of that form, right? And that's where we can, that's where we link with sort of the more, what I would characterize as the more traditional perspective from operator theory. Okay, so let me point that out. Okay, so in other words, the dual of the isometric form, what does it look like? Well, if E of rho is equal to trace over the environment, and V rho dagger, okay, with a little calculation, you can check that this is equivalent to the dual map. Okay, the dual map satisfying this equation. So it's V dagger V. Okay, but in the middle, we've got X tensor the identity on E. Okay. All right, now this links us with one of the fundamental results, really, from operator theory and operator algebras, okay, known as the Steinspring theorem. Okay, so the Steinspring dilation theorem. Okay, so it has, I guess it's evolved to have a few different forms, but here's, from this perspective, this is what it looks like, okay, with the notation we have on board. It's going to be a theorem on unital CP maps, okay? So let's use capital Phi now to be a unital completely positive map, okay? Well, basically, the theorem says that the map, we can find a Hilbert space E such that, and an isometry V such that the map has this form. Okay, so then there exists so a Hilbert space E, okay, and you can always do it with dimension bounded above by the square of the dimension of the initial space. Okay? And an isometry V, okay, going from H into the tensor product, okay, such that the map itself looks like, so 5x is equal to V dagger x tensor the identity on E V, okay, for all x. Okay. So, yeah, thanks, sorry. Okay. All right. So this is, I think this theorem, at least when I started working in quantum information a few years ago, this theorem was not known at all. And in fact, when I mentioned it, I didn't write it down even, I mentioned it in an early talk I gave to a quantum information audience. I was asked, what is a Stein spring? By someone in the audience. So that sort of suggested to me that there was some work to do to let people know about this. But now, I'm seeing this perspective mentioned in more and more papers, and I mean let's point out, I mean, this is a special case. This is the finite dimensional case of Stein spring theorem. And what's really going on in here? I mean, why do you get this X tensor the identity? Well, it's really a fact about representation theory embedded in that statement, namely the general Stein spring theorem looks. More general form looks something like this. It looks something like this, where pi is a representation, okay, of the algebra you're looking at. As it happens in the finite dimensional case, the point is that all the representations of B of H are actually unitarily equivalent to multiples of the identity representation. Okay, so that's really why you're seeing this. Okay, that our representations in this case are equivalent to a multiple of the identity representation. Okay. So, sorry, lost. Oh yeah, right. Okay. Time. Right. Okay. So there's Stein spring theorem. Now, what I want to point out, since I've got it on the board and I've got notation set up, what I want to show you that from the Stein spring theorem itself, you can easily get to this generic form, okay? Right. Okay, so let's. Okay. All right. So let's. I mean, we could always. So without loss of generality, we can assume that E has its maximal size. Okay. So let's assume that E. Let's really assume that E is H tensor H, okay? Okay, so if we identify, yeah, let's write it like this. So if we identify make that identification, then we can go one step further and we can identify the entire space as the direct sum of H with itself a bunch of times, how many? N squared times. Okay? Okay. So we have a coordinate system with N squared coordinates. Each of those coordinates is a copy of H. All right? Now, what does that mean for this isometry? Right? This isometry is going from H into that space. Okay, so but with that coordinate identification now, what does that tell us that V looks like, right? I mean, V is going from one copy of H to H a bunch of times, right? So if we think of each of these coordinates as a map on in its own right, right? What are we getting? We're getting operators that go from H into the different copies of H, right? So let's define those. So define coordinate operators. We'll call them, okay, EI on H via the action of a V. Okay, so V of a vector in H right? It's going to give us a vector in this coordinate system, but I'm going to define these like so, E1, E2, etc. And I mean, just the definition of V allows you to show that these really are linear operators, everything's fine. Right, but what does that mean? In other words, what this means is that we can really think of V as a column operator. Okay, so we can really think of V as the column operator that goes from, right, H into this tensor product, or we're thinking of it as the direct sum. Okay? All right, so that's a simple observation. But now if we apply this form, okay, to this coordinate system, if we apply that form to this coordinate system, we get, what do we get? So 5x, okay, so V dagger, X tensor identity on E, V, well, that's equivalent to saying, so E1 dagger, E2 dagger, etc. And then, okay, well, you could reorder the tensor product to, well, you just have to decide on an order, but the point is it looks like this. Okay? Do the multiplication, right? You get, lo and behold, the that generic form for a CP map. Okay? So, all right, this is for unital CP maps. But again, we have a connection with the CP trace Missouri maps from somewhere that through, right, with this form in the way I stated before. But, I guess I wanted to point out how this generic form really, it really even just drops out of Steinspring's dilation theorem in the finite dimensional case. And so, in fact, maybe what, just to be controversial, maybe what we call Krauss operators, we should even call Steinspring operators. But, that might be. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly, yeah. And in fact, if I had managed my boards better, I would have left that up. But remember, I stated when I introduced the dual map, I showed that, yes, when the map has this form, remember, that immediately gives us exactly that. Well, using rows, that the dual map has the corresponding form, right? And unital is the dual of trace Missouri. Okay, so somehow everything flows out, or at least a lot of this stuff flows out of the Steinspring theorem. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, very good point. So this gives us existence, doesn't tell us how to get our hands on them. So, for instance, one way you can get, so since I introduced the Choi matrix, I can say that one way you can get the EI is to get the eigenvalues of the Choi matrix. But so I'm not going to be able to cover everything I want to. So let me just jump. Yeah. Okay, I got off. So this is one of my favorite things, and obviously I just went way off. I went way over time on it, but I think it's beautiful, and I think it's something that should be better known in quantum information. But okay, so I stopped there, and not the talk, but I stopped this discussion and realized that I have two more sections to do in 5 minutes. But 10 minutes, okay. But things are not that bad because so I wanted to say some things about CP maps and the CP norm, but I know that there are a number of talks we're going to see, and some of them will be at an introductory level. I know Ed Efros is giving a going to give us an introduction to operator spaces. And John Wantress, after me, is going to discuss the CB norm. What's that? Yeah, well, he's actually going to define it. Don't worry, I spoke to him. He's going to define it. So, I've lost track of where I am. Okay, randomly pick a board now. Okay, so there are only so many hours in the day, I guess, right? Yeah, so let me very quickly say a couple things about CB maps and the CB norm. Now, okay, in the finite dimensional case, really what we're talking about are linear maps and a special way of measuring them, okay? But again, so I'm going to have a linear map on B of H with H n dimensional. The fundamental example in quantum information is going to be a difference of CP maps, okay? So E1 and E2 being CP maps, and you want to say somehow how close they are together, okay? How close they are to each other. Now, a norm that was introduced in the mid-90s-ish, okay, in quantum information by Kitaev was called the Diamond Norm, okay? So it has an exotic name, but we'll see it's dually related to something fundamental in operator theory. So it's by definition the trace norm, okay, the trace norm of the map identity on N tensor with phi. Now the identity on N is there one of the main reasons it's there is to get the stabilization property satisfied. Okay, so this satisfies the stabilization property. Namely, that the Diamond norm of a map is equal to the Diamond norm of any map you get by tensoring that map with an arbitrary identity map. And so, in the context of quantum information, this was no, it's
or you need to define
it. It was so the Diamond norm was initially defined like this, but then Kitaev proved it was it actually satisfied the soup property. But I'm going to get to that through the CB norm very shortly. Okay, so yeah, so that's all right. And that's right. Right, but okay. So this norm, it's going to be discussed in John's going to go into much more detail on this. I just want to give the basic definition and indicate how they're related through the dual picture. Okay, so that's the Diamond norm, the completely bounded norm, or at least there's a wide variety of completely bounded norms. Now, but sort of the initial one looked like this. So the completely bounded norm of phi is defined to be. So the soup now over all the operator norms of the identity the nth identity tensor with phi. Okay, so here's the definition of the CB norm. In general, so phi is a CB map, completely bounded map, if and only if that number is finite. I'm about to wind up. Yeah.
All right.
So this is the operator norm or the infinity norm. So it's the it really is the operator norm when you're viewing this map as an operator on operators. Okay.
Operator on the Hilbert space
on B of H, basically. Yeah. So it's an operator on operators. So thinking of it it's operator norm in that sense. Okay. And if you like, you can think of it as a an infinity norm, which is going to be dual to the one norm, which is what, yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Okay. So I was trying to sweep that under the rug, but you called me out. So I mean. So by the one norm. Yeah. So it means what you think it means, basically. Okay. So the one norm again of an operator. So on operators. Okay. So it's a soup over. Trace norm less than or equal to 1 of phi of x trace norm where that really is so the trace of the so the real trace norm of the operator itself. Okay, so yeah. Yes, okay. So I'm really running out of time. So let me just point out that what is the connection? Well, so as I mentioned, Kataev established the stabilization property for the diamond norm in the mid 90s or 97, but what's that? So Kataev proved this for the diamond norm. The corresponding fact for the CB norm was proved by Smith. Okay, so this is my last point, and I'll exit stage right. So the CB norm satisfies the stabilization property, the corresponding one, in the dual picture, and this was, proved by Smith. Well, years before, but I mean they're independent. I mean it's coming at it from different perspectives. And with that in hand, together with the duality relation, so I pointed out, thinking of that as an infinity norm deliberately, because you can think of there's a duality relation between these, between the one and infinity, which allows you to show that, and I'm going to skip the lines of math, there's two or three lines in between here, to show that the CB norm of a map is actually equal to the diamond norm of the dual map. Okay? All right. Didn't cover near what I wanted to do, but onwards and upwards. So.